been there yet. So a monastery fell on hard times. The monks were getting older. The buildings were getting run down. They weren't getting new recruits. People from the community were not coming anymore to their worship services and some of their prayer gatherings. And the abbot of the monastery got desperate. He knew if something didn't change, they just didn't have a future. So he had heard about a rabbi in the community who was known to be very wise. He set an appointment. He went by, poured his heart out to the rabbi, and then said, "Have you got any advice for us? Anything to recommend?" And the rabbi just thought for a long, long time, almost as if he was hesitant to share his real thoughts. Finally, he spoke. "The Messiah, the Christ, is among you." That was it. The abbot went back to the monastery, assembled all the monks, told them what the rabbi said. The rabbis dispersed, the monks dispersed, but they had some excitement. Could it be true that the Christ is among us, in one of us? But which one? So they began to treat each other differently, to treat each other with a little more respect and honor and joy, because the Christ is in one of them. Pretty soon, word got out to the community that something's happening at the monastery. People began to attend the worship services and the prayer gatherings. Nobody could say just what it was, but it was evident to everybody. There's just this new level of joy, this new love, this new appreciation for each other. Young recruits started coming to the monastery saying, "We want to join your community." And that is how the monastery rediscovered itself, because they looked for the Christ in one another. We conclude today this series we've been following in the month of October, thinking really about this core thought that if we treat each other as sacred people of worth, it will change our world and it'll change the world around us. We've done this during this election season that, again, is very significant, but it is more divided, and I feel like it's uglier than ever. We do this so that we might practice countercultural values of people who really do respect and love and try to understand one another. That's the whole focus of the Golden Rule. That's why we've been lifting this up every week. We started in week one looking at the first two words Jesus spoke. In everything, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. We focused on in everything, in every situation, with every person. And we took out of this idea that the Golden Rule communicates this thought that it requires understanding of each other, that we really have to work at understanding one another. We took a little detour the second week. We talked about how Christian nationalism might actually be a threat to the Golden Rule. And then last week, Kylie Larson, did she not do a great job? She got us back on course. And she thought about how the Golden Rule teaches this understanding of respect, that it resists being contemptuous toward one another. And she helped us think about what does it mean to practice respect with each other. Today, I want us to focus on the last words of the Golden Rule. Jesus said, "Do unto others as you would have them do unto you." And in the NIV translation, it says, "For this sums up the law and the prophets." That's Jesus' way of saying that this statement pulls together everything about life and faith. The law and the prophets, the sources of what it means to believe in God and how we are to live in the world as people of faith. Jesus says, this is the sum of everything. Why would he say that? Why and how could this statement really be the sum of everything about faith and our life in the world? Let's think about that. We've talked about respect. We've talked about understanding. I want us to look at one more word today, compassion. That the golden rule teaches the value of compassion. Now, when you hear the word compassion, what do you think of? Do you think of a feeling, an emotion, feeling sympathy for what somebody else might be going through? That's part of compassion, but it's a small part. Compassion is a very deep word. Actually, compassion is not a comfortable word. It is the combination of calm, which means with, and passion, which means suffering, as in the passion of the Christ. Compassion means to suffer with others. To be willing to suffer with others. Compassion isn't just some comfortable word in which we show sympathy when it's comfortable, when it's easy. It's a difficult word. How many of you have had to ever suffer some people in your life? Have you got any folks you have to suffer them? Because to respect them feels like suffering. Because frankly, you just don't find them very respectable. To understand them feels like suffering because you just don't want to understand them. And they don't show much understanding toward you. This gets at the heart of compassion. When we show respect and understanding, not because it's the popular thing to do, but it's the right thing to do. It's the needed thing to do. Consider John McCain, who ran for president in 2008 against Barack Obama. He was at a town hall meeting in Minnesota, and he said some things that were not popular at all, but not for reasons you might think. Take a look at this.
First of all, I want to be president of the United States, and obviously I do not want Senator Obama to be. But I have to tell you, he is a decent person and a person that you do not have to be scared as president of the United States. Now, if I didn't think I wouldn't be one heck of a lot better president, I wouldn't be running, okay? And that's the point. That's the point.
I got to ask you a question. I do not believe in, I can't trust Obama. I have read about him, and he's an Arab. He is not.
No, ma'am. He's a decent family man, citizen that I just happen to have disagreements with on fundamental issues, and that's what this campaign is all about. He's not. Thank you.
Don't you wish we had more of that today? You watch that now, and it feels like eons ago that we would talk that way. Some say that John McCain's campaign suffered because he did not join in the character assassination of his opponent. Now, we might not call that compassion, at least the way we readily think of the word. But if compassion means being willing to suffer by showing respect and understanding, then that's every bit of what compassion means. One of my favorite stories that illustrates compassion in the Bible is from the Old Testament. It's about the prophet Elisha. It was during a time of Israel's history when the nation of Aram was conducting raids on Israeli villages, crossing the border, causing terror and havoc, killing people, going back to Aram. Well, God gave Elisha clairvoyant knowledge of where future raids were going to occur so that he could call the Israelite generals and tell them, and they could be there ready to protect and defend the village. The king of Aram thought he had a traitor in his council, somebody telling the enemy what he was going to do. And his advisor said, "You don't have a traitor, they have a prophet. He knows where you're going to attack." So the king of Aram said, "Fine, let's hunt down the prophet and kill him." So the scene now shifts to the home of Elisha. And one morning, his servant wakes up and goes outside, and he sees that they're surrounded by the armies of Aram, and he begins to panic. And Elisha comes out and says, "Don't worry. There are more with us than there are with them." You'll want to hold on to that sentence. The next time you're surrounded by opposing forces and you feel afraid, you'll want to remember that. You'll want to personalize it. There are more with me than there are with them. So when the armies of Aram begin to move down the hill to attack the prophet, he says, God blind them so they can't see. And they were blinded. And he goes to their leader and he says, "You're not in the right place. You're not on the right road. If you'll go with me, I will take you to the person you're looking for." So he leads the armies of Aram into the capital city of Israel, Samaria. They get inside the walls, the gates shut, and then he says, "Now, God, open their eyes." So the army opens its eyes, and they see that they're surrounded. They are in the enemy camp. They're done for. This will be the last thing they ever see. And the king of Israel comes to the prophet, and he says, "Shall I kill them?" Do you remember in the reading a moment ago, he actually says it twice. You ever wonder, like, what's the purpose of that? Shall I kill them? Shall I kill them? It's kind of communicating what happens when we get excited. We can't help it. We start saying over and over, "Shall I kill him? Shall I kill him?" Like, I can't wait to get rid of my enemy, to get rid of the reason I cannot live in peace. Shall I kill him? And the prophet says, "Did you even lift a finger to capture this army? Of course you didn't. Here's what you're going to do. You're going to put a feast in front of them. You're going to feed them. You're going to give them something to drink, and then you're going to send them home." Now, how popular do you think that was? But the king knows not to cross the prophet. So that's what he does. He feeds them, gives them something to drink, sends them home. And then look at the last line in this story. This is the key to the whole story. "And the Arameans no longer came raiding in the land of Israel." That was the goal, to have peace. But they thought that in order to have peace, I've got to annihilate my enemy. When in reality, it was compassion that reached the goal. It was compassion that accomplished the mission. Compassion changed their world and the world around them. There's someone with us today who is a testimony of the power of compassion in his life, Emmanuel Pugh. And Emmanuel, if you would come up and join me. I tell you what, I'm going to let you first begin by just introducing yourself, and I'll keep far enough from you that I don't infect you in any way. How is that?
Good morning, church. I am Emmanuel Pugh from Tanzania, a third-year medical student. I visited last year at St. Luke's. I know some of you. I know Amy. this is my second time visiting St. Luke's. Thank you again for having me back. Thank you.
So, Emmanuel from Tanzania is with us today, and after the service, he's going to be talking about a United Methodist mission called Angel House that's in Tanzania. Just say a quick word about what Angel House is.
Angel House is an orphanage. Actually, we don't call it anymore an orphanage because it has gone beyond that. It is a children's home that was built in 2005 due to orphan crisis in Tanzania. So the orphan crisis is so high due to diseases like malaria and HIV, accidents and tribal wars. So Angel House was built for that reason by one of the United Methodist missionaries who came over and surveyed the area and saw that. Actually, the land that Angel House is built on, it was given by the village people, like, build this property here to help us with this burden.
So it started as an orphanage.
Yes.
It's become more of a school.
Yes.
And what is your story in terms of Angel House? How did it impact your life?
So Angel House Orphanage, it started an orphanage in 2005. In 2011, it started a high school. Now it expanded its ministry of not only helping orphans, but help children who come from poor families that their families could not support them get their education. So I am one of the beneficiaries of that. So I come from a polygamy family.
Polygamous
family.
Your father has how many wives?
Six wives. Yes. And my mother is the third wife. I am the seventh child out of eight children from my own mother. So think about this, six wives, and none of the wife has less than six children. But in the whole of this huge family, I am the only one who has been able to make it to university because of the support I get from Angel House.
So you've got a lot of siblings. Somebody spots in you that you have great education potential, and they tell your father he needs to go to a special school.
Yes. So growing up, I went to a public, like a government school, elementary school, where the education is very poor. Like a lot of students in one classroom, 100 plus, so there is not enough chairs. Some of us could sit on the bricks and stones. The teacher, in order for him or her to control the class, sure, he has to come with a stick to hit for us to be quiet. For those who come from Africa, know this better. So I was performing well in the elementary school, so the teachers recommended to my father to take me to the private English medium school in town, and my father accepted. So he did that by selling cows, of which he had many. So in my culture, for a man to look wealth and respected, he has to have three things. Many cows, of which my dad had many. So for you, if you have many cows as a man, you will marry many wives because you have cows to pay dowry. And if you have many wives, you will have many children. So my dad has all these three. So he was kind of wealth according to my
child. So when you're getting married and you have to pay a dowry, you're doing that with cows.
Yeah.
So your dad amassed a lot of cows. By the way, Emmanuel is getting married in a few weeks when he gets back home, and he had to have a certain number of cows to get his fiance. And if you go to the meeting afterward, he can tell you how many cows he had to provide for that dowry. So, all right, your dad has all these cows, and then something tragic happens.
Yes. So all 290 cows from my dad, it was like a cow ranch, so they were stolen, 290 cows. So he lost his wealth. So Holly, who was the youth director at Paul's Church, knew my story. By then, she was in Tanzania raising funds for building a high school, so knew my story, and that is why Holly decided to take me to Angel House for further education.
So Holly was Paul's youth director at his church in Kansas, went into the mission field, was at Angel House, and took notice of Emmanuel. And without a chance to be in school and have that chance for education that other people saw, special gifts in you, she got you plugged in. Her compassion for you gave you an educational opportunity.
Yes.
And so now you've completed your third year of medical school.
Yeah. Actually, I start my fourth year, 16th of November this year. So one more year to go. Thank you.
And then, real quick, where do you want to be in 10 years?
So in 10 years, I see myself running a medical clinic in my own village. So, yeah. I will finish in 1 year to come, and my goal is to come to United States to do my residency and then go back home to start a medical clinic to help solve prenatal, natal, and postnatal problems and pediatrics and child health as well. We also have a lot of infectious diseases in Tanzania, so that will help. From my village to the government hospital downtown is 9 to 10 miles. I have seen many women delivering their babies at home where the hygiene is very poor. I have seen women delivering on their ways to the hospital, being carried on the bicycle, so they end up like doing everything on the way. Actually, it has happened even to my own relatives. Hmm. So I have this burden of going back to my village and start a medical clinic. And I believe it will be so.
So you're going back and leading a medical clinic is going to save lives.
Yes.
It will save lives, it and it'll help a future generation of children who might not have a chance. So the compassion you receive, you're going to be passing it on.
Yes.
So you're going to hear more of Emmanuel's story if you go to the meeting right after this service, just down the hall in N101. And I really encourage you to do that, to learn about this great ministry called Angel House. Would you join me in thanking Emmanuel for being with us today?
Thank you, Father. Thank you.
When you get around places where compassion is fostered, it will save your soul. When you get around something like Angel House, you'll just find life coming back into you, because you go through these national elections in our country, and every 2 years they just seem to get uglier and more divisive and bitter. And if you're like me, it sucks the life out of you. Instead of hearing politicians lift up a hopeful vision for our world, we hear people name-calling and attacking each other, and it causes us to start to look at each other skeptically, fearfully. And we need something to save our souls again. And when we get around compassion, it saves our soul. Let me close with a quick story about how this happened to me last week. I am part of a pastor's group, a fellowship, and they only meet one time a year in early to mid-October. Different pastors take turns hosting us. And so we met last week in Montgomery, Alabama. And one day, their lead pastor, Jay Cooper, put together an incredible day for us, visiting all of the sites of civil rights significance. Many of you have done the civil rights tour. You've gone to the Equal Justice Initiative by Bryan Stevenson, to the museum and the memorial, the walk that is along the river in the garden. So we did all of this. But Jay said, we're going to have a really loaded day because I want it to start early in the morning in the old Dexter Avenue Methodist Church. That's just down the street from Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, where Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was the pastor. That's a picture of the church where he preached. At that time, just down the street, Dexter Avenue Methodist averaged about 1,000 people in worship. But when the civil rights movement broke out, they had over half their congregation leave. Over time, the church continued to dwindle to where it could no longer sustain. So my friend Jay Cooper is at First Methodist at Montgomery. And a friend of his from high school, a guy named Anthony Brock, he learns, started an academy with his brother Fred. They're African-American men who wanted to begin an academy in which young African-American males would have positive black role models to look up to, men, in an environment where there is a commitment to learning in a creative way. So the conference gave them the property of Dexter Avenue Methodist Church and deeded it to them for Valiant Cross Academy. Jay said, I want us to go for their opening ceremony. They do it every day, and I want our group to experience that. When we got to the church at 7 a.m., a group of the boys were already waiting to get into school. They had their bow ties on. They would be adding their dress jackets when they got inside. We went into the sanctuary. Praise music was playing. And Jay said, now we're going to sit toward the back, because when the boys come in, they're going to line up in rows, and they're going to be in perfect rows, side by side and in front of each other. They did this like military response. One of the student leaders came up, and he would shout, and the people would shout back. I took just a brief picture of it on my camera. So, I mean, I was sitting there thinking, boy, this is a serious military structure with these boys. They did a little devotion, and then when they broke to go to their classrooms, they left row by row, youngest to the oldest. But on their way out, they all went to the altar to kneel. And then the leader of the academy, Anthony, and because his friend Jay was there that day, he's a part of this from time to time, he joined them. And they knelt down with each one of the boys and put their arms around them and whispered in their ears. They whispered things like, "You matter to God. Don't forget that. Your life is important. It's important to me. You're loved. I loved you. God bless you." Because they want every boy to know you're blessed. And I don't know why, but I just sat there watching this and tears started coming to my eyes. And maybe it's just because of how parched my soul has been with just all of the divide in our country. But I sat there and I went, that's what hope looks like. That's what our world needs, where we give people a blessing every day. When we talked to the pastor afterward, to the director of the academy, I said, you know, this was like a combination of military academy and revival. And he said, well, my dad was a Methodist minister, and he was very structured. I grew up in a very structured home. So one of the things we want to have here is a high expectation of what the boys can be and become. But I also grew up knowing I'm loved. I grew up with an awareness that I'm blessed. So we have high expectation, but we got high love. You got to have both together. Could it really be that simple? That when we focus on blessing people, that's the hope for our world? That simply doing unto others what we wish they would do unto us and giving them the blessing first, that maybe that's the hope? Jesus would say yes, except for the word maybe. Oh Lord, as we complete these weeks, we thank you for reminding us that we are blessed, but we're blessed to be a blessing. And in the times of division, and separation, and fear, let us be bold to own and do that which is within our power to bless, to let you bless other people through us, to show compassion, whether it's earned and deserved or not, to give what we need, to share what we hope to receive, and to live in the kind of world we so desperately want. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.